From the studios of Radio Sai at Prashanti Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. So 2 days ago, I met one of my friends as I was having my lunch in the Western canteen and we got to talking on some very deep topics. So I told him, why not record a chat for the radio, as I was sure the listeners will enjoy the topic that we discussed. So dear listeners, with me today is a person who is much wiser than his age, and he is Mr. Natesh Shetty. Natesh joined Swami's institution at Alike in Karnataka for grade 11 and 12, after which he joined the BSc program at the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning at Prashanti Nilayam in the year 2003. He did his BSc honours in chemistry and then went on to complete his master's in chemistry in the year 2008. Thereafter, he joined the MBA program in Swami's University, which he completed in 2010. Through his years at the university, Natesh was quite active as a member of the university brass band, played the saxophone on many occasions at the Sai Kulwant Hall in the Divine Presence. Apart from the band, Natesh was also actively involved in the various drama presentations that the students put up before Swami. He was very fortunate to be a part of the convocation dramas during his final years in the college. Natesh was also blessed with the golden opportunity to speak in the Divine Presence few times in Sai Kulwant Hall. After his academic stint at Prashanti Nilayam, he decided to pursue a deep calling to serve society. So he has pursued a career as a certified hypnotherapist. He currently works at Whitefield near Bangalore, where he helps people connect with their own inner self and heal their problems. So with that introduction, dear listeners, here is Natesh Shetty. Sai Ram Natesh, and welcome to Love to Love.
Sai Ram Chandu.
So let's begin at the very beginning, let me begin by asking you, how did you come to Swami, or how did you come to join Swami's institute here in Puttaparthi?
My parents have been devotees right from the time I was a little child, and so I was brought up in the Sai fold as such, and I have lived in the Gulf, so I was brought up in the Gulf, and it seemed pretty natural for me to aspire to be studying here in Puttaparthi and, you know, wanting physical proximity with Swami. So it was just a natural thing. After class 10, I had applied to Alike.
Swami's school in Karnataka,
Alike. And I got through, and I did my class 11 and 12 there. And from there I applied here for the BSc program, and I got through here, and thereafter I've been here in Parthi. I've done my BSc, MSc, and MBA.
So you are a musician. You have been a part of the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning brass band, but you also play the keyboard and the harmonium, of course. And you are also a dramatist. You have been a part of so many dramas which were put up in the Divine Presence as an actor, and I'm sure also as a director, etc. So let's talk about your days in Swami's University, the experiences you had. What do you have to say about that?
I have spent 7 years here at the university. And now when I look back, it's an amazing journey that I had undertaken at that time. And I see myself to have grown in practically every aspect of my life. And so I was always very, very interested in all forms of arts. And here I got lots of opportunities with music and dramatics. So I joined the band. The band was a huge part of my stay here. It was really an amazing experience, you know, with the band, especially with such a huge group of musicians of, you know, from different backgrounds, different walks of life, and all of us learning, growing together.
What about dramatics? As an actor, you have acted in so many dramas in front of Swami. So I'm sure you would have had some kind of interaction with Swami with regard to the dramatics.
So we've had lots of wonderful interactions with Swami, but very interestingly, most of the interactions did not necessarily involve very big topics and, you know, where Swami talking about earth-shattering things and revelations, but it was all about very simple, small day-to-day things. But, you know, it was such a great experience to see the amount of interest that Swami took. So it was a drama that we had planned to put up for the August 15th. We had practiced, we had, you know, prepared a lot, and we had even got Swami's approval of the entire story. And Swami had taken so much of interest in the whole drama, and, you know, he had discussed the scenes with us in the bhajan hall. And it was such a great experience, you know, to listen from Swami how he wanted certain characters to be portrayed, because he was at that point very, very passionate about Subhash Chandra Bose.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he really wanted us to portray him a certain way, and we were doing a particular episode in Subhash Chandra Bose's life where as a young student he actually tells his teacher, you know, he actually speaks up and he asks his teacher to respect the Indians a little more. There was one episode, and Swami was really passionate, and, you know, he had even wanted us to show the scene where, you know, Subhash Chandra Bose actually goes back and slaps his teacher.
Okay.
You know, and it was as dramatic as that. And Swami wanted it that dramatic. And, you know, Swami had made statements like, you know, when Subhash Chandra Bose slaps that teacher, the sound should be heard.
Okay.
Everybody should hear the sound. And, you know, it was such a revelation for us that, you know, Swami was also so passionate about Subhash Chandra Bose and, you know, his passion for the country. And so we prepared that, we planned that. And out of the blue, so August 15th was supposed to be the program, and on August 14th, suddenly Swami came in for the final practice and he just saw the drama and he saw the same scenes.
Okay.
And then he said, I don't like this drama. Too much violence.
Okay.
And he just said, cancel.
Okay.
And it was pretty shocking for all of us, considering that, you know, he had given us the permission and the inspiration to, you know, pick up some of these stories, and he was very well aware of all the scenes and all the episodes that we are portraying. And suddenly, it seemed like a great shock for all of us that the program was being called off. But then later, there was one statement that Swami made as he was leaving. And he said, you're saying Janani, you're saying Janmabhumi, you're saying Mother, you're saying Motherland, and all of you are fighting, 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 fighting all the time. At that time, it seemed like as if he was referring to what was happening on stage. But then slowly later, you know, it dawned on us that during the course of the program, the preparation, the practices, we did have certain, you know, amounts of
differences of opinion
amongst us, you know, because it was a very short period and all of us wanted to, you know, do the best and impress Swami, and each of us were passionate and so many opinions and so many suggestions, and, you know, at some point we had to say, no, this is not going to be done, this is going to be done this way.
Okay.
And there were certain, you know, differences, and there were certain people who, students amongst us, who felt, no, maybe, you know, my way of portraying this would have looked better on stage. And it slowly dawned on us that, you know, as long as there were small pockets amongst us that felt that, no, this is not the best way, and this could have been better, we were not united. And this is something that even subsequently in the next drama, again, it was practically the same group. And again, at that time, Swami just brought it to our notice and he said, it's not just the final performance. And, you know, it's what goes into it, what goes behind the performances that really matter to me. And it was the same, I guess, even with the band, because there were so many times when it really didn't matter how great we played on the final day or how badly we played on the final day. What really mattered to him was how we functioned as a group and how all of us really got together as one group and performed together as a group. And I guess that's what really touched Swami or did not impress Swami when that did not happen. And so that's something that I learned through my entire stay, that, you know, more than the destination is the journey that really, really matters to Swami, and that's all that he's really looking at.
That's beautiful. Now, after you finished your course here, when you went out, you are still a very active part of the Rhythmic Energy Group, which constitutes of the alumni band members who are a part of the University Brass Band when they were students, and now they are all scattered around all around places, but still they come together, they practice, they put up programs at different places. You are so still very actively involved with music even after you passed out. And you also became a hypnotherapist. So how did that all come to happen?
Well, after I finished my education here, one thing was very clear in my head that I do not want to get into the routine, you know, the rut.
Okay.
And
a desk job.
Yeah,
just
get into that and, you know, report to somebody and just do what I'm told. It didn't make sense to me, and I felt I had received far too much here to just keep quiet about it. And there was something that I really wanted to give back. And it was basically that sort of a very unconscious, you know, deep within urge to just give that I that actually pushed me. So I took a huge break of a year after my education, and I just wanted to figure out what am I really, you know, looking at? What do I really want to do in life? And that's where I started looking at hypnotherapy. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, sort of struck a chord with me, rang a deep bell inside. And I just started doing the courses out of curiosity. But then somewhere it really, really resonated with me. And I just felt so connected with this, you know, this whole form of reaching out. So basically it was a form of therapy.
Yes, yes.
But then the field, the science itself involved touching people deep inside and just finding out what are you really feeling deep inside, deep within. And it could be positive, it could be negative. And how do we sort of help you grow, you know, by connecting to your own inner depths, inner recesses.
Now, before you go any further on that, let us clear the air on what exactly is hypnotherapy. Because when you talk about hypnosis, hypnotherapy, the first image that comes to your mind is somebody like sitting in front of you with a pendulum saying, go to sleep, 3, 2, 1, and the other person sleeps, and then, you know, you can make him do whatever he wants. And when that person gets up, like, did I say something, you know? So what exactly is hypnotherapy?
But the thing is, I would like to call hypnotherapy as a meditative form of therapy. So when we say hypnosis, most people assume hypnosis is being unconscious,
yes,
right? But on the contrary, it's actually being super conscious,
okay,
right? So when you are under hypnosis, you are so aware and so conscious of everything. So you are so aware of even the vehicles honking on the road outside. Okay, you could be aware of maybe a fly or a mosquito flying around.
Okay, okay.
Right? And you're also equally aware of what's happening inside of you. Right? You suddenly start becoming aware of thoughts, of emotions, of deep-seated pain. Okay? That we might have suppressed, repressed, and maybe blissfully forgotten. And suddenly we realize how our mind is actually at the core of our life, and how it is either contributing to us or not contributing to us. And basically, it's a state of heightened awareness. So that's how I'd like to call hypnosis.
How do you bring people to that kind of awareness?
So we have certain techniques, which, you know, scientifically they have put down, saying that these are techniques that help the mind to attain this level of, you know, relaxation and awareness. And scientifically, if you look at it, they say that the brain, we have brain waves which are measured in the EEG,
okay,
electroencephalograph. And so we say that there's an alpha wave, there's a beta wave, there's a gamma wave, there's a theta wave, there's a delta wave, right? So in a typical waking state, we are said to be predominantly in the beta state. So that is predominantly our brain waves are of a beta level, of a beta frequency. And lowering the frequency is relaxing the mind.
Okay.
So, you know, we can bring the mind from a beta state to the alpha state, and that's the next lower level. And from the alpha, it goes down into a theta state. And from the theta, it goes into a delta state, which is deep, dreamless sleep.
Okay. Okay.
Right? So, a lot of our meditation happens at the alpha state, where, you know, you're coming down from the beta, the, you know, the constant,
from rajasic,
yeah,
to sattvic kind?
A little, maybe? Yeah, a sort of a sattvic.
Okay.
And a theta is a far more deeper, relaxed state where you're very, very calm and stable and you're just looking at things for what it is,
okay,
without really judging anything.
Yes, yes.
Right? So
basically you are relaxing the other person to us.
Yes.
To us.
To put it
level,
very crudely,
yeah,
it's just that.
Okay.
It's just taking this person to a state where he's just one level above sleep.
Okay.
Right? Because delta is sleep.
Okay, yes.
And
yes,
so theta,
yes,
is just one step above that. So you are in that semi-conscious sort of a state. All of us go through hypnosis every day.
Okay.
Like if you, you know, if each one of us were to think, there's probably this one small phase every morning when we are awake and we can hear people talking outside,
yes,
we can hear the birds
yes,
chirping.
I've experienced that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yet our body is not yet up. Yes. Our eyes have not yet opened up. But then the thoughts start and we are suddenly aware of the dreams that we've had. We're aware of what do I need to do this morning. We're aware of everything, and that's also the time when some deep-seated emotions can come up really strong.
Hmm, okay.
Right? If you're, let's say, angry with somebody or you're sad about something, you're upset, you're scared, these emotions can really come and hit you at that time in the morning. And maybe a little later, the intensity would be far less and you might even look back and say, why was I so scared? But those are the real emotions that are there inside. And that is a state of hypnosis, where you're so aware.
So now, being a hypnotherapist, how has it affected your life? How has it changed your life?
It's changed my life in many ways. One, more than anything, it's just helped me understand myself. So how this helps me with my work is, the more I understand myself, the more I realize that everybody is just like me. Right? And we are all equally human and we are all equally vulnerable to life, yes, to various life situations, and we all feel emotions. And so just understanding myself, what makes me happy, what makes me sad, what makes me angry, what makes me depressed, what makes me anxious, what makes me scared, just understanding and clearing that is so much of a revelation to me that it actually helps me help others. Okay. Right? And so that's very roughly put how it has helped me and how it is helping me to help others.
spoke about you being as a musician, you are a part of the band. So where does music and hypnotherapy meet? In the sense that you're very active part of the RE group, as I said before. So you're constantly playing music. At the same time, you're constantly busy with your work as a hypnotherapist. So do you think there is a meeting point between you being a hypnotherapist and you being a musician?
Yes, there is. There is a huge meeting point. So before that, I'd just like to introduce this group.
Okay.
Rhythmic
yes.
Energy.
Yes.
So that's the alumni band. So many of us who have been a part of the Institute Brass Band here at Parthi, we were also fortunate to be trained here by world-class musicians. And, you know, Swami has personally taken a lot of interest in ensuring that we are playing right, we are marching right, and we are performing smartly and, you know, in a very professional way. And we've received so much from Swami and from all the wonderful teachers here. So it was a sort of an inspiration that some of the seniors had once they had left, where they felt that, you know, come on, we have to do something about this. We've received such world-class
training
and we cannot just let it go. And so the first step was, okay, we need to procure instruments. And very often we'd not find instruments like trumpets or euphoniums and French horns and trombones every day, you know, available in India especially.
Yes.
So it also, so that became our, you know, the unique selling factor. So we started looking out for the instruments. We procured these instruments and we formed the band. So we sort of regrouped, and a lot of the alumni from across the batches. So we've had people from the 1980s, the early 80s, who were personally handpicked by Swami and, you know, trained by the trainers then.
Mm-hmm.
And right down to the recent batches, and we've all sort of regrouped. And so then we started deciding that, okay, so now what? What do we do? We need to also perform somewhere if you're just, you know, meeting up. So we decided that we'll start reaching out to the underprivileged in some ways. So we started going to the orphanages. We started going to maybe some old age home or homes for terminally ill. And the objective was, you know, we play music for them. So in that way, we are in touch with our music. We are in touch with our instruments. And we're also spreading love, because that's what we had primarily received from Swami, right? So we wanted to go back and spend time with these people and just play music for them, just have fun, talk to them, and spend an entire day with them, maybe a Sunday. Just spend time with them and connect with them and bring some smiles on their faces. So that was the, you know, the first thought that led to the formation of this band. So today we are still doing that, and of course we have played at slightly bigger levels also. We've played for larger audiences, and we've played at various different cities in India as well. We've traveled around a bit of late in the last couple of years. But still, at the core of it, we are most interested in playing for the orphans, playing for people who are a little less privileged than most of us. So where this resonates, where this meets with me is, I just felt that, yeah, that's also something that I do as a profession also. Because at the end of the day, even this is healing. Music also is healing, and my even as a profession, I'm looking to heal people.
So when you're talking about music as healing, in the sense, like when you're playing for orphans and underprivileged children, I'm sure they'll feel very happy listening to the music. I mean, everybody feels happier listening to music. And then, depending on how the performer is, it could be better or less. I mean, how lively the performer is. But other than that, like if suppose you play for half an hour, after that half an hour, how do you think that music that you've played, do you think that is having any other deeper impact on the person who's listening?
So, which is where it's not just the music that we go and offer there. Right. Very often, sometimes we are even, you know, we spend a good 1 hour or 2 hours after we have finished our musical performance, just connecting with the children. Like the very recently, we had been to one of the orphanages in Bangalore called SOS, and you know, we finished our performance by say 5 o'clock in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and we were there with the kids up to about 7:38. We visited all their rooms. We spent a lot of time with them, just sitting and talking to them. And, you know, the kids were so happy, and they were so, you know, connected with all of us. At the end, they were telling us that you please come again next week. And, you know, then they said that we have our annual day on this day. Will you come? You'll promise, you know, do you promise that you'll come?
Okay.
Please come. And then, you know, they came with us up to the car, and even at the car, they were, you know, sort of, you know, pulling our sleeves and saying, please come again. Next Sunday again, you come.
Okay, okay.
You come. You don't play the music, you just come. You know, and so, definitely we feel that, we are touching them. And at some level, they do feel a lot of love, a lot of acceptance, a lot of appreciation from us. And I guess that's what everybody wants at the end of the day, right?
I think in at the same level, even you are getting so much from them.
Absolutely.
The amount of love that you get from those kids,
absolutely.
I think even that is priceless.
Yes. And that's where it is all, you know, it all goes back to we are always giving, receiving, giving, receiving. And the more I receive, the more I want to give. Right, so each time I have played for any of them, we have received so much of love, so much of appreciation, and so much of, love. And so we invariably tell them that, you know, the love that we are sharing with you is the love that we've got from Swami.
Yes, yes.
And we know what it tastes like. So we're just sharing that with you. And invariably, you know, they all tell us that, oh, Satya Sai Baba, yes, yes, we know. Oh, Puttaparthi, yes, yes, we know.
Okay.
And there's a lot of respect that we get. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of association that people, and they just feel connected, and they know, you know, that here is somebody who understands me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we receive that as well.
Okay.
And they call us. And so we have, so there are so many calls that we get, and sometimes it's difficult for us to even keep up with the calls.
Okay, okay.
As in, you know, they say, come, you know, we would like you to spend some time with us. We'd like you to do this with us.
That is beautiful. Spreading Swami's love.
Yeah.
Through music.
Through music.
Beautiful. So now again, getting back to the question of the meeting of music and hypnotherapy. You know, I've heard of this term called music therapy. So where does that fit in?
So the way we look at everything happening around us, we believe that everything is energy. And everything that's happening is a flow of energy, right? So when we start looking at things from that perspective, from that lens, we start seeing that even emotions are energies, right? So when we say emotions, emotions are energies in motion.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
So that's the way I look at emotions. So emotions are also energies, right? So when I'm feeling happy, it's not that I'm happy.
Okay.
It's more like I'm vibrating at the frequency that we call happiness.
Okay.
And it's a frequency. So when I'm feeling sad, I vibrate at that frequency. When I feel love, the love of Swami,
yes.
I vibrate at that frequency. And so the thing about energy is it sort of, you know, we can transfer energy.
Yes.
So if I am vibrating at a certain state, I can transfer my energies to you.
That makes sense, because you see that people are happy, and if you're around them,
you feel happy as well.
Yes, yes.
Right? Swami was such a strong force, was such a strong energetic being that radiated unconditional love, which is supposed to be the highest frequency in this universe.
Yes, yes.
Right? And so anything that comes in his proximity is raised in its frequency. Right? So
I think that's why Swami said, you know, there is a quote of Swami which is, never underestimate the power of my darshan. I don't know if you
absolutely
read that quote.
Yes, yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have. Yeah, yes. Because that is the vibration that he gave out as a single being, right? And all of us have our own vibrational states. So, and a lot of our vibrational frequencies depend on what we are feeling and thinking. So,
yes, yes.
Simply because Swami had felt and experienced only love, he commands such a strong vibrational field. And because we feel so many different emotions at so many different times in our day, in every day, we have different varying frequencies that are present in us at the same time. Right, so where music comes in between is, music is a form of expression. It's a form of communication as well, right? So one, if I'm playing music, the music that I play is often an expression of my own vibrational field.
Okay.
Okay? And which also, you know, for me to play good music, I will have to raise myself to a higher vibrational state.
How do you define, when you say good music, do you mean playing in Shruti and beat, or are you talking about something else?
Shruti and beat is a physical aspect of that, which is, yes, necessary and there, but there's something more, which very loosely we call as bhava.
Okay.
Yes. Right? So when we say bhava, raga, tala.
Yes.
So very loosely it's called bhava, but then I think it's so much of the energies that I put into the music, the intent that I put into the music. Right? So when I go and play with the intent to make somebody happy, automatically the frequency of music that I play is of a higher frequency. It's of a higher vibrational state. But when I go with the frequency of just making a living, maybe the frequency could be a little lower because there could be a certain amount of desperation. There could be a certain amount of stress.
Hmm.
Because it's about making my living and I might carry my own emotional issues into that. Right, so automatically the frequencies could drop.
Probably that's why sometimes you hear two people singing the same song, and then you can always connect to a song better when you hear from a certain person than from the other person. Maybe because it's because of that energy that he puts it into the song.
There's something that probably you resonate with that person. Right, so it's a lot about resonance. So probably you might find another person who resonates with the person you did not necessarily okay. appreciate.
Okay. Yes.
Right? Because maybe he resonates with that. Right? So, it's so much about energy. So, when I connect with the vibes of one person, I might also like his singing. Okay. I might also like his music. And if I connect with the vibes of another person, I might also like his music and his singing.
So, does this have any relation to the fact that there are so many genres of music? There is rock music, there is pop music, there is country music, there is classical music. So does each of these genres, do they have a certain kind of energy associated with it?
Yes, I believe so. Very loosely put, again, we call some music as very tamasic music, very rajasic music, very sattvic music. Right? That's very loosely put, but then there are so many factors that go into it. Right? So, there are certain forms of music that are played by very, very intense people who feel a lot of intense emotions. Okay. And if you actually go back and study their lives, the musicians' lives, you will find that there has been a lot of pain probably. There has probably been a lot of varying emotions that they just put out to their music. And so there are a lot of people who also resonate with that music, who connect with that music because it gives vent to their own emotions of a similar frequency. Right? So, and there are certain other types of music which we feel is, oh, this is so meditational. Oh, this is so meditative. Oh, this is so healing. This is so beautiful. So divine. Right? Probably because the intent behind that music, the musicians playing that are of a different vibrational state. And there are a whole different set of people who connect with such music. Because maybe their own vibrational frequencies and their emotions and their thoughts match.
Okay, okay.
Right? And we all have different needs. We all have different expectations. We all have different ways of expressing ourselves. So it's a whole lot of factors that go into the different genres of music and who connects with what type of music.
When you speak about music therapy, what kind of music do you use to heal?
The music that most resonates or rings with the person who I'm working with.
Okay, so it is not one, it's not like I play a small piano, a slow piano piece and that is the healing music. It is not.
No, not necessary because, like I said, every form of music has a particular frequency and every person also vibrates at a certain frequency. And so, if there's somebody who has gone through a lot of trauma in his life, he might not resonate with classical music.
Okay.
It might seem like a lot of, you know, it might be very irritating for him.
Okay, okay.
Right? And it could actually disturb him more. And maybe he would like a little more intense music. Say something on the lines of metal or hard rock or I don't know, things like that. Right? Simply because that might help him express better or that might make him feel more at peace because that's where he resonates. Right? So, when we are working with therapy, we first allow them to express, because what's really at the core of it is that you have not expressed your emotions. You
people
have not
holding back.
You're holding a lot things back, and probably you're not even aware of what you're holding, right? So, it's best to express yourself, express through music, and some people they don't necessarily have to play, but even just listening can help them express, can help them release, can help them connect, right? So, we give them the music that resonates with them, that they connect with. And once, so where the therapist comes in between is when you have reached a certain level of expression, and when, you know, when the therapist recognizes that, yeah, now you are ready to change.
Okay.
And that's when he starts giving them slightly different types of music to alter,
okay,
you know, the consciousness, and now start inducing different frequencies in their state of being. Right? So it's a gradual shift from something very intense to something that's a little more peaceful or a little more calmer.
Fine, fine. So slowly you bring him down to the classical music level,
yeah,
instead of straight,
yeah,
away giving him classical music, which,
yes,
he,
yes,
may not appreciate it.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
That's
fine. It's like, you know, very crudely put, even in our therapies, one-on-one therapy, when I'm working with somebody, if there's somebody who holds a lot of anger for another person, I cannot tell him, okay, you need to forgive this person. It doesn't make sense to him because he is so
consumed
by the pain and the anger that he feels. It's very insensitive of me if I tell him that, all right, all said and done, you need to forgive this person. It doesn't make sense. Right? So I will have to first get him to be willing to try to forgive that person.
Yes, yes.
And only when he is willing to try to forgive, can he start changing.
It's like what Swami Vivekananda said, that you cannot give spirituality to a hungry person.
Absolutely.
You have to give him first food.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. So give him what he needs right now first. And only when he's satisfied right now, can he think of the next moment. And we take it moment by moment, step by step, and slowly bring about a change.
So now, yesterday we had a long discussion on karma. What is your take on karma?
Karma is probably one of the most discussed topics, and there are so many, so many interpretations by so many wise people. So I do not really know if my understanding or interpretation is really the best.
Yeah, we're just asking for your understanding.
Yeah. So in my own way, I have understood a few things. The first thing that I have come to understand is that we often believe that karma is, if I have done something good is going to happen to me. And if I have done something bad is going to happen to me. And the converse of it is, if something bad is happening right now,
is
that means I have done something bad in the,
yes,
past.
Yeah.
Right? But this whole concept of good and bad, right and wrong, does not exist beyond the human mind. Right? So, karma is not at the level of the human mind. Karma is formed, understood, at a level that is far beyond the human mind. Right? And at that level, at that space, there is no judgment. So there is no good and bad, there is no right and wrong. So from that space, from that level, everything is just an act. Everything is just an experience.
I guess that's why Swami says everything is perfect.
Everything,
yeah,
is perfect. Absolutely. And everything is meant to be exactly as it is meant to be, as it is happening. So we might say that, oh, there's a war happening there, but that's so bad, there are so many people dying. But that's from my perspective, that's how I look at it. Maybe from up there, from beyond the human mind, that's perfect. And that is how it is meant to be. Right? And the person who is responsible for that need not necessarily be having bad karma because of that, because maybe he's just playing a role. And so, karma need not necessarily be, if I have done something bad is going to happen to me, and if I have done something good is going to happen to me. So that's the first thing, to just step out of this whole realm of good and bad, right and wrong. Because that's a very, very human understanding of life.
So what you're trying to say is, karma is basically, it's basically action-reaction. Swami says it's about reaction, resound, reflection. The whole universe is just reflection, reaction and resound. So you do something and something happens to you. Now, what is, whether you did, what you did is good, or what happened to you is good or bad, it is basically all your understanding and it is your perspective. From up top, it is, you have done something, something has happened to you. It is not good, neither bad.
Yeah. And how best I can create a sense of balance at the end of the day. Maybe I could give you a small example that I've worked with. So I also work with past life regression.
Okay.
And I help people resolve karma by stepping into the past, by just opening up your past lives and looking at what went wrong at what point and how is that still impacting me right now. And I was working with this one person who was addressing something totally different, but as we were working with past lives, we happened to stumble upon one lifetime where he had been a sadhu, a saint, an ascetic who was in the Himalayas, and through his meditations and his spiritual sadhana, he attained the siddhi of being able to touch and heal people. So, and he was very ecstatic about that. He was very excited about his gift. And so he decided that, yes, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to serve. Right? So he came back onto earth, and I mean, he came down from the Himalayas, and then he just started going around, reaching out to people and asking them, okay, so is there anything that's bothering you? Is there anything that's, you know, not resolved in your life? And whenever he would hear of any issue that people had, be it a physical body issue or some financial issue or some other emotional issue or anything, he would just touch and heal. Right? And he started touching and healing everybody, whoever he came into contact with. And that life he spent that way. And what we realize, so when we're doing this past life regression, we also have the ability to touch on the soul and look at what's happening at the soul level between two lifetimes. So that's the stage where your karma is getting resolved and, you know, you're sort of balancing it out and seeing what's not balanced. And at that stage, he suddenly realized that, oh, I have gone and healed a lot of people who are not meant to heal. Right? Because there were so many people who had maybe a cancer that was supposed to be there, that was serving them to release a lot of pent up emotions.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay.
Right? And that cancer was serving them. That was good for them. And by he going and healing that cancer, he had actually gone against the soul purpose, and from the highest perspective, that did not serve them, serve their soul.
So these people, they have to be reborn again.
So at some level, his good karma,
yes,
good in quotes,
yes,
became binding for him. And so as a soul, he had to take back those energies that he had given to heal. And so he had to be born again. Right? To take back the good that he had done to them.
Okay.
And now the interesting part, the second interesting part was, this soul decided to be reborn as a pickpocket.
Okay.
On one of the railway stations here. Okay? And it seemed very contradictory to me that, oh, he's such an evolved soul and such,
yes,
a great spiritual aspirant who has attained such wonderful gifts from the divine. And why would he be born as a ordinary pickpocket? But then from that perspective, there is no high and low, good and bad, right and wrong. So even a pickpocket is as holy and spiritual as that, the sadhak. So he was born as a pickpocket and he chose to pick the pockets of exactly those people whom he had healed in the previous life.
So this is a subconscious decision?
It's a great subconscious and probably a decision that's happening at the soul level.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's a very unconscious thing. So it was like a contract between the souls that we will resolve the good karma that I have done to you. I will balance it out by taking this money from you. And that's how I will settle it. And so this soul came back as a pickpocket and led a very, very ordinary, mundane life as a very typical pickpocket to settle the extra energies that he had imparted to these people that was, you know, not called for. And it just made so much of sense to me because even here I have seen, I used to often wonder, you know, Swami is God and Swami can heal. So why doesn't Swami just heal everybody? But then he doesn't do that. Because each of us has an aspect of our life with a great divine purpose. And it's not that everybody is meant to be healed.
Hmm.
Healing is by going through our issues.
Yes, yes.
So if there were maybe 100 people who came to Swami, Swami would probably ignore, say, 75 of them also. Right? And very often we would feel that, why is Swami ignoring them? But there's a reason. And sometimes it's not in our understanding, it's beyond us to understand that, but from the soul perspective, it's best for them to go through it.
Thank you. दुर्गा भवानी साई माता
दुर्गा भवानी साई माता
शिव शक्ति मई साई माता
शिव शक्ति
शक्ति मई साई माता
शिव शक्ति मई साई माता
अभय प्रदायिनी साई माता
अभय प्रदायिनी साई माता
अभय प्रदायिनी माता
प्रेम प्रदायिनी माता
तुम हो प्रेम प्रदायिनी माता
प्रेम प्रदायिनी माता
दीजो कृपा भवानी साई माता
दुर्गा भवानी साई माता
काली कपालिनी साई माता
काली कपालिनी साई माता
काली कपालिनी साई दुर्गा भवानी साई माता
दुर्गा भवानी साई माता
शिव शक्ति मई साई माता
शिव शक्ति मई साई माता
अभय प्रदायिनी साई माता प्रदायिनी माता
तुम हो प्रेम प्रदायिनी माता
दीजो कृपा साई माता
दीजो कृपा साई माता
दीजो कृपा साई माता
दीजो कृपा
दुर्गा भवानी साई माता काली कपालिनी साई माता
spoke about there is nothing like right or wrong. I think that is a very interesting point because only when you realize that there is nothing like right and wrong, you can be non-judgmental. Correct. And that's what, I think that's what Swami was.
Absolutely.
He was never judgmental on anybody.
Absolutely.
A thief would come to him or a sadhu would come to him and he would treat everybody equally.
Absolutely.
So I think literally for Swami, there was no good and wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Even things like, you know, I hear a lot of people ask me, non-devotees who do not know about Swami as we do, they come and ask me that, you know, if he was really God and if he was really divine, why didn't he just heal everybody?
Yes.
Right? Even from that perspective, they believe that pain is bad.
Yeah, yes.
Or suffering is bad. But there is no such thing as good and bad, right? So even suffering is perfect. Right? And
you are basically undergoing what you are meant to undergo for your own good.
For your, yeah. And there's
correct?
A purpose.
Yes, yes.
So even, I would not say for your own good, but there is a purpose for that.
Okay, yes. You're just saying there's no good and bad,
yeah.
Correct.
But with a purpose.
Yes, with a purpose.
And
the purpose is to get back to the source.
To get back to the source and reach a state of balance.
Balance. No, balance in the sense, karmic balance.
Karmic
no
balance.
Good karma, no bad karma.
Absolutely.
Neutral.
You're just neutral.
So before a while, when you were speaking about the story of that pickpocket, you said that he chose to give back whatever the good karma that he had taken by taking their money. So money, this is a very interesting point because, you know, there is a spiritual healer whom I know and on their website, it said that this is the fees, you know, this is a fees for healing. And I was just wondering, if he's a spiritual healer, why should he charge fees? So I went to the fact section of their website and it said that the reason we charge money is because of karmic reasons. Okay, and they had given some explanation. So how is karma and money related?
So to just start with this, I myself am a spiritual healer and I myself do charge for my sessions. And at first, even I very naturally felt guilty being from the system. I felt that, isn't this wrong? Isn't this bad that I'm charging money? And
because we got free education, Swami
absolutely.
Gives free healthcare.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Yeah. But then my answers came from Mrs. Phyllis Crystal.
Okay.
And she's a great healer
yes.
in her own way.
Yes.
And she's also a great devotee of Swami. And I believe that she has really had wonderful personal interactions with Swami where she's clarified a lot of these questions. And a lot of the answers came to me from her. As I was going through her books and I was listening to her talks. And one of the things that Swami had told her is that, one, this is your profession.
Yes.
And if you are choosing to help, you have every right to be paid for it because it's a service that you're offering professionally. So that's one. And two, it's something that you are using to sustain your livelihood, like sustain yourself. So karma and money also comes in between because when I am helping you, when I am helping somebody at this level, at the level at which we are talking, very often these are life lessons because we have not come here from, you know, the higher planes to just live our life and go to office and, you know, do our job and get married and have a life, right? We are here for something much more, and that something much more is at the inner level. To sort out our emotions, to understand ourselves, to understand our own inner divinity and all of that. And in some way, I am helping you do this. I am helping you accelerate on this path. Right? And actually, at the soul level, I am playing a great role in your spiritual development, which can turn out to be good karma.
Okay. Yes.
And good karma is also binding. Right? So there's a lot of debt or that indebtedness that you might feel as a soul for helping you accelerate your journey. What you might have taken the next 5 years to finish, I might finish here in the next 5 months with you. Right? And so there's a lot of indebtedness that you might feel. And so to settle that, either we both have to come some other time, and now you would return that favor to me by helping me accelerate in my journey.
Okay, and then you keep doing that.
And we could keep doing that.
Okay.
Or we could just choose to settle it right here.
Okay.
Right? So money is used as a medium to settle a lot of this, you know, to sort of balance it. Because I have given you this, now you have given me back this. Right? And so we use money as an instrument to settle these energies and to not feel this debt. At the soul level, at a much deeper unconscious level.
Okay. Because Swami had said many times that you should not give money to, for example, beggars. You know, one of the reasons that people say it is so, because not sure if it is Jesus who said it, buy a man a fish and then you have helped in then and there, but you teach a man how to fish, you have helped him for life, right? So people interpret that by saying, yeah, there's no point in giving money to beggars because it's a temporary help. You have to teach them, you know, you have to, if you really want to help a beggar, you teach him employment kind of stuff. But another perspective that I have heard is that I heard from somebody that suppose you give money to somebody for free, just like that. You give away, for example, 2,000 rupees as charity. Suppose if that person misuses that 2,000 rupees that you have given, apparently bad karma comes to you. Why does that happen?
Again, this is just my perspective and my understanding of it. But then money is an extension of me because I have created that money. So let's say I'm working, I have a regular job, I have a job in some company. I am working and toiling every single day to feel that I deserve this money that I receive at the end of the month.
Okay.
And so I have worked to create that money. If I do not work as much, I might receive a much lower pay. If I work well and if I do well, I might receive a higher pay by means of some promotions or whatever.
Okay.
Right? But at the end of the day, the money that comes to me is quite directly responsible or proportional to how much I put in.
Okay. How much work you have
How much work,
in.
Energies, efforts I have put in, right? And so, I have directly created that money.
Okay.
And it involves all that which I have gone through in that last 1 month. Right? So if I have gone through illness, there might be a pay cut.
Okay.
If I have been in hospital, there is a possibility that I might have a cut in my pay, right?
Okay.
So my money is also reflecting what I am going through. So there's a dip in my energies, there's a dip in the money. If I am putting in extra, I might be due for a promotion or, you know, whatever. So it comes back to me and that money is directly a mirror of what I am giving in. And so what I do with that money is also an extension of me because that is my creation. So if I have taken money from my pocket that I have created, I have put in my energies to create, my emotions, my efforts, my concentration, my dedication, all of that, they are all my energies. And if I pick up that note and that money, and if I were to give it to somebody, I am actually giving them a part of my energies, a part of my being, because that money is me. And so what they do with that money is a direct consequence of, or it's directly connected to me, because they have not earned that money. They have just received that money. There's no give and take happening. So it's just an extension of me that's going there. And if tomorrow they were to buy cigarettes with that money, it's as good as me buying that or me contributing to the cigarette or whatever, you know, that energy involves. It's my energy is going there. And so I am connected with that energy. Right?
Yes.
On the contrary, if I were to receive a service from the same beggar, if I were to tell him, all right, just clean my car up.
I'll give you the
same and I'll pay you this. I might pay him any amount, right? But then at some level, he feels he deserves the money. And so automatically there's a give and take, there's a balance. And now I am no longer connected with that money because I have received something back from him to complete the loop,
yes,
to complete the circuit.
Okay.
Right? So he has earned the money and now that rightfully belongs to him and henceforth it is his energies. But when I have just given it away without using my discretion, sometimes it might come back and bind me instead of binding him. Because he is often considered to be, I mean, he could be looked at as an ignorant person.
श्यामला रूपा गोपाला
नील मेघ श्यामला रूपा गोपाला
नील मेघ श्यामला रूपा गोपाला
नील मेघ श्यामला रूपा गोपाला
नित्यानंद स्वरूपा साई गोपाला
नित्यानंद स्वरूपा साई गोपाला
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందనా సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందనా సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందనా సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందనా సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నీల మేఘ శ్యామలా రూప గోపాల
నీల మేఘ శ్యామలా రూప గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందన సాయి గోపాల
ఈశ్వరాంబనందన సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల
నీల మేఘ శ్యామల రూప గోపాల నిత్యానంద స్వరూప సాయి గోపాల.
టాకింగ్ అబౌట్ గివింగ్ బ్యాక్, యు నో, యాజ్ స్టూడెంట్స్ ఇన్ స్వామీస్ యూనివర్సిటీ వీ హ్యావ్ రిసీవ్డ్ ఫ్రీ ఎడ్యుకేషన్. Almost all convocation discourses that Swami gives, when he addresses the outgoing batch, Swami says, I don't want anything from you except for your gratitude. So, as for all that he has given us, all he is expecting back from us is just gratitude. And Swami is also very clear as to how you should pay the gratitude. He doesn't say, so as a gratitude, go and change the world, go be, you know, do that, do this. All he says is, be good human beings, earn a good name for your family and for yourself, and earn a good name for the university, right? So how powerful do you think, because I know that so many healers actually use gratitude as a tool to heal. So in your perspective, how powerful is this? Expression of gratitude is to a person's life?
Gratitude is a very, very high frequency. It's very high simply because gratitude is very close to unconditional love. Because if I am truly grateful to you, I am looking beyond everything that is bad or unacceptable or not so right about you and choosing to be grateful to you despite all of that. So it's very close to unconditional love, and it's a very, very high frequency energy. So even though as students we have not necessarily paid money for our education,
yes,
we have offered a lot of gratitude to this institute, and it's a very natural thing that happens for each one of us because we have received such high vibrational energies from here, be it in terms of education or just grace or knowledge or wisdom or love.
Or just being inside.
Or just being here. Absolutely. The energies are so high, it just, you know, naturally and automatically invokes a lot of gratitude in us.
Mm.
And that's the, it's a natural state of being, because when we have received, we also feel like giving. We cannot contain it. It goes back. Right? And so in that way, the energies are balanced. There's a healthy energy exchange and a balance of energies between the system and us. And that's how we give back.
Yes,
so
yes.
I would not really say that, you know, we've got free education.
Yes.
It's free of cost.
Yes.
But then we have received a lot and we're also giving back a lot.
Yes. As Professor G. Venkatraman says generally, he says there is nothing like free lunch.
Absolutely.
There is a cost for
at an energetic level.
Yes.
We are balancing it out. And it's all about balance. At the end of the day, that's all it is.
Now it makes so much sense, you know, like why Swami could have said that you have received your education. Now it doesn't matter what you do because I love you unconditionally. So it doesn't matter. Just go whatever he wants. But he asked for gratitude back.
Absolutely.
He was very clear.
Yeah.
You know,
and the other thing he asked for, invariably he said, be happy.
Yes.
Right? That's one statement that he kept saying every interaction with every student. At the end, he would say, be happy, be happy. Every time I had gone for a birthday blessing to Swami, Swami would say, be happy, be happy. And you know what I realized? That's one of the toughest thing to do sometimes. Right? Because this constant quest for happiness actually led me to get into healing, to get into spiritual therapies and then help others. And at the end of the day, what am I trying to do? I'm just trying to achieve happiness for myself. And that's that one single sentence that Swami said, be happy. And that's how it could take an entire lifetime for me to find that happiness. Right? And that itself is such a great, and when I am happy, there is no option but to spread that happiness. Because like I started by saying, if I have to do therapy for somebody else, at the first step, I have to understand and heal myself. Only when I have understood and healed my own issues, my own, you know, expectations, my own emotions, my own weaknesses, so to say, only when I have done that, can I find happiness myself, and only then can I share it with somebody. And that is such a great service. Right? And that is such a great ask from Swami. And just by finding my happiness, I can spread so much of happiness around. And so they are very, very loaded statements that Swami has made.
Yes.
It sounds so simple,
correct,
be happy.
Correct. Yeah, I know.
And it's a whole lifetime that could. It's not one life, it's 100 million lives that could change.
Now, as a professional hypnotherapist, you know, a lot of people come to you, all kinds of people, with different kinds of problems. Now, how do you not be judgmental? Was it very easy for you not to be judgmental, or did it take time for you to reach that stage of not? Because judging people is something generally people do every day. Yeah, you see a person there, you judge him. You see a person in a particular dress, you judge him. You see a person in a particular car, you judge him. So how to be non-judgmental?
It was, I don't know whether to call it easy or difficult, but it was more of a conscious practice and an effort where I realized that I cannot afford to be judgmental. Simply because so the first rule of a therapist is to just listen and accept everything that the person says and everything that the person is in front of you, right? Without having to say that you're wrong or you're bad. Because the moment I say you're wrong or you're bad, he doesn't feel the need to sit in front of me. Because it doesn't work.
Yes. And you can't help him then. The whole purpose is defeated, right?
So if anything has to flow from me to him, I have to have the channel open. And for me to have that channel open, I had to consciously tell myself, even this is perfect. Even this is okay. Even this is okay. And so as a very consciously in my day-to-day life, I found myself telling, you know, just telling myself that that's also okay. That's okay. That's also perfect. That's also fine. That's also acceptable. Even that is right. And let me see what's right about this. And the more I kept telling myself that, I started finding myself being able to see how various things serve people. Right? So if I find that somebody is very arrogant, without having to judge that person, I could see how that is actually helping him mask his own fears or mask his own stress and prove to others that, yeah, even I'm strong. I'm not weak. And it serves him that way. Right? But the moment I'm able to see that, I'm suddenly able to feel the compassion for him. And it just helps me look beyond the arrogance or beyond the anger or beyond the, you know, the masks that people have.
Don't you think this is such an important thing, not just for hypnotherapists, but for everybody?
Absolutely.
Because everybody wants to help, right? I mean, as I devotees, Swami says to serve. So service is a kind of help. How can you help someone if you're judging that person?
Absolutely.
Correct?
Yeah.
So everybody has to be, that's why I felt this question was important. So as you said, it is not something that happens to you. It is a conscious choice that you have to make for yourself, not to be judgmental.
Yeah.
Whenever you see something apparently bad in your eyes,
you
have to realize that, well, in the bigger picture, there is nothing like good and bad. I'm just saying this.
Yeah.
This is actually perfect.
Yeah. Interesting practice that I sort of developed on my own was, you know, sometimes I would consciously ask myself, all right, if Swami was sitting here and listening to this guy, how would he react? And then I would have an image of, okay, so this is how probably Swami would do, this is what probably Swami would say. And I would find myself saying that or being that or doing that. And it happened, you know, I had to again consciously practice doing this. And I practically kept saying, okay, if Swami was in this situation, what would he say? And very, very often, I would say 99%, 99.99% of the times, I would get, you know, get the answer in my head. Swami would say, okay, Bangaru, no problem.
I know, right?
Right? And so, very obviously and naturally, I would find myself saying that. And the moment I said that, I would find a huge change in the person sitting in front of me, because he would suddenly feel so accepted, so loved. And he would suddenly feel that, oh, there's nothing so wrong with me, I'm okay. Right? And so that was another practice where which I consciously did. What would Swami say to this? Mm-hmm. How would Swami react to the situation?
Of course, we have heard about this before, but I think it's good to remind people, because I think as SI devotees, this is the easiest way to practice being non-judgmental. To ask yourself, what would Swami do or say?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it also, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily that I have to be nice or I have to be, I have to allow people to walk over me like a doormat. Because Swami never did that as well. And there were times when he had to be stern, and he would be stern. He wouldn't allow somebody to just take him for a ride or take him for granted. Right? So sometimes that's the loophole, or that's the so when I kept asking myself, what would Swami really do? It's not always that I got an answer that Swami would be nice and
yes.
Know?
Okay. So I think that raises another very important question. When you ask yourself, what would Swami do? How do you know the answer that you're getting is the correct answer and not your mind playing games on you? Is it like, before you ask the question yourself, can you do something to make sure that you're getting the right answer? And you put it that way. In the sense, like, you know, any practice where you try to connect to Swami.
So what I have done, what I realized is, the more I stepped out of right and wrong, the more clear was this sort of a communication channel or this connecting with Swami. So
okay.
to say, right? The more I'm able to step out, because if I have a judgment that this person is fundamentally wrong, this is not right.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay? That's me there.
Yes.
Okay, so at that state, I really cannot connect with what would Swami say or how would Swami respond to this. But the moment I go with the thing that this is also fine, this is also perfect, but what would Swami say here?
Okay.
And so suddenly I would start getting a different perspective. With the thing that, okay, so this is where he is. Right now he is feeling this. Mm. And if he is going to continue to feel this, it's only going to take him downwards in the spiral. So I need to right now be stern to help him step out of this frequency or this emotion. And so I would use that sternness only to help him step out. Right? And what that also means is that I would not be connected with that emotion.
Yes.
Which is something that we always see with Swami. Swami would shout, or he would, you know, take somebody to task,
yes.
and the next moment he would have so much of love to shower.
Yes.
He would never be consumed by the anger.
Correct.
And that's the hallmark of, you know, his anger, or his emotions for that matter. He wouldn't be consumed by that
yes.
emotion.
Correct.
And so when I have found myself using this emotion only as a tool,
correct.
I never felt myself remaining in that emotion. It was just a snap of a finger and I could step out of that as well. Because I am not going with the thing that this is wrong,
yes.
and you're doing something wrong to me.
Yes.
So there's no me involved.
I think we all could do that as children. You see children doing that, right? A baby will be crying, and the next you give him a toy, and the next moment the tears just disappear and he's smiling. But somewhere in the course of our life, we just lost that talent, and now when an emotion happens, we get caught up in that for the next few days, whether it is happiness or sorrow, or success, anything, right? It just happens.
Which is where inherently we are all carrying imprints. We are all carrying various experiences that we've gone through across lifetimes probably, maybe in this lifetime also, where we have felt a certain way deep, deep down inside. Right? And that is what continuously rings. So sometimes I might have gone through some experience, maybe with my parents, or maybe in some, maybe with some teacher. Okay, as I was growing up, or maybe with some friends where I have felt maybe very inferior, maybe I have felt very disrespected, and I'm fundamentally carrying that. So every time I get angry, it's more like, oh, you don't respect me. And that's what triggers me, and that's what makes me angry.
That is because you were disrespected sometime in your childhood. You felt that way.
And I'm carrying that. So that's so much of my issue, and so it becomes so difficult to step out of that.
Yes.
But the moment I have looked at that, healed that, and healed the disrespect that I have felt, and understood that actually I am respected, and there is nobody, no force on earth that can actually disrespect who I really am. And when I have connected to that, understood that, I really do not feel any disrespect coming from you or from anybody else. So that's when I can step out of that. And I'm even able to look at that disrespect from a perspective that is beyond good and bad. Right? So that is what is the process of healing, which I work with people on a one-on-one basis. So when, and I do it with myself as well. It's a process. It's a journey. So I'm not going to say that I am there. It's an ongoing thing. I still have my own judgments. I still have my own weaknesses that I'm working on. And I'm still growing and learning. But then this is a process that each one of us is in. And when we have stepped out of this, is when we can start looking at others and looking at life without this judgment of good, bad, right, wrong.
I think even the concept of living in the presence, right? I think even that comes, it's so connected to this, right? If you are living in the now, you're not carried away by the emotions that you've, something happened a few hours ago. Somebody might have shouted at you at the gate maybe 2 hours ago, but now you are at this moment. You're not bothered about what happened. Absolutely. There is this beautiful story of few disciples, Buddhist disciples, who were about to cross a river, and then there is this beautiful lady and she asks for help. She asks them if they can help her cross the river. So one of the Buddhist disciples, he carried this lady across the river. And then they were walking, and after a while, one of the other disciples said, "What did you do? I mean, how can you touch a woman? How can you carry her across the river? Don't you think it's against all our principles?" And then this disciple who carried the woman said, "I had dropped that lady 3 hours ago. You're still carrying her in your head." Don't you think this story is so apt for the situation that we go through?
Often, very unconsciously carrying things for centuries, across lifetimes. And it's so inherent and so much a part of our being that we don't even recognize that we're carrying it. We don't even realize it. So, which is where sometimes a therapist, somebody sitting outside of you, can look at it and tell you that, you know what, maybe you're carrying this. And sometimes just the awareness of it helps you drop it. Like if you were to take that story ahead, maybe the moment he realized that, oh yeah, I'm carrying that woman in my head still, okay, he might have just dropped it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And yeah. Sometimes it's just that small push that we require.
True.
And help us come back to this moment, to the now. But yes, being in the now is so, so important. And the moment you are completely in the now, you are actually so connected with your own inner divinity and what you're feeling. And that's what is being connected to Swami.
Great. So thank you, Natish. Thank you for this conversation. I'm sure all the listeners enjoyed it as much as I did, discussing about all these issues. I think these are all very important issues, because many times we hear Swami talk about a lot of things and then we don't really understand these at a much deeper level. So we just follow it for the sake of following, you know, because Swami has said it, we are doing it. And I think that kind of following is a bit flawed, because after a while it is possible that you might start to question as to why am I doing this, you know, what am I achieving? I'm not achieving anything. I've been following Swami all this while. So I think it is very important that to understand why Swami said a certain sentence. For example, when he said, "Give me gratitude, nothing else. I don't want anything but gratitude." Now it became very clear to us during this discussion as to why gratitude is such an important thing to give back. So with that, I think it is time to conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chandu.
I hope that maybe sometime in the future, we can have another
chat. Yeah, I would love to be here again.
Great.
Shankara Abhayankara,
Shankara Abhayankara,
Shankara Abhayankara,
Shankara Abhayankara.
Yeah.
భయంకర
శంకర భయంకర
సాలగా ప్రియ శంకరా అభయంకరా